This week, I've been thinking above all, as I'm sure you have, about the attacks in Paris, about what they mean for the people of Paris, for the Syrian refugees in Europe, for all of us. George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's written about the Iraq War and about domestic politics in the United States, and he recently wrote a long article for the magazine about the lives of Muslims in France. George, you spent quite a long time in the suburbs of Paris and the banlieue talking with people, and they must have had a lot to say about what's been happening in the last 10 days or so.
I asked the main character, as we say in the business, of that piece, Fouad Ben-Ahmed, what it was like this time compared to after the January attacks, Charlie Hebdo and the kosher market. And he said, well, the good news is there's no real debate about any justification as there was for that one, because for some French Muslims, Charlie Hebdo was a Islamophobic, racist, bigoted publication. And
they saw it as a provocation.
It was a provocation. And as for the Jews, there was not an outpouring of sympathy for them either, to be honest. But this time it was so random. It was just every young person having a good time in Paris on Friday night. And many of them were Muslim, as it turned out. So, or at least a number. So there's no sense of what does this say about free speech versus Islamophobia versus correct interpretation, blah, blah, blah. There's unity on that front. There's massive fear. And I think Muslims are anticipating a real backlash. People are being rounded up. I don't mean large numbers, but suspects are being rounded up who had not been arrested before. So it's a different atmosphere. I think it's much harsher.
Now, in your article, you wrote that 1,500 French citizens have gone to fight for or live in the so-called Islamic State. They are not all poor. They are not all dispossessed. In fact, in their majority, they are middle class.
I don't know that they have a real accurate statistical sense of the class of the jihadists, but it's true that all the experts said to me, we used to think we could profile them. The profile was they're poor, they come from broken families, they get into delinquency, they get into petty crime, they go to jail. In prison, they often get radicalized because that's where the cells begin.
And that's not the profile now?
It still is of some of these guys, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. A couple of them came from more middle-class family, so it's very hard.
So what is the motivation? This is of course, the lasting mystery that we've been all grappling with for years. What is the motivation of a young man or a young woman to at some point embrace what to our ears can only seem like a kind of medieval absolutist version of Islam, be willing to kill an unlimited number of people and blow oneself up?
It's pretty damn hard to answer that question. I mean, first of all, I stay away from the word medieval because I think even though they think they are interpreting the Quran according to the period of Muhammad and his companions, this is a modern phenomenon to me. It's pulling in young people from different backgrounds but through an ideology that says to them, you may feel like nothing. Society may offer you nothing but consumption and good times or exclusion and contempt. We will offer you everything, the world, a vision of the world made whole. One of the people I met in France was a British scholar who said it's like the cloud, the computer cloud. It's always up there, and wherever you are, whether you're a young guy in Tunisia or a young woman in a small town in France, or you can lock onto it in your own way. It can find you and you can find it.
Hmm. In the wake of 9/11, the Bush administration went the way it did. And one of the forces trying to hold back and in its mind speak reason to the United States and the government were the French, particularly in the decision to invade Iraq. Now you see France moving to the right. Concerns about security will inevitably start to overwhelm concerns about civil liberties. What do you think that dialogue will be between the United States and France?
Because President Obama was opposed to the war, he's in a good position to be able to say, we are not giving you unsolicited advice. We're not talking down to you. In fact, we're expressing a sense of admiration for your wisdom about Iraq and about falling into the trap that the jihadis always set for us. On Monday, President Francois Hollande got up in front of the French Parliament and said, France is at war, which reminds me very much of the days after September 11th. And there's almost an inevitable tidal pull in that direction. The public wants to hear that something is being done. The public wants their own alarm answered in some way. But it does worry me, as I think it seems to worry you, that they are going to fall into that trap again. They may start with these roundups and with, you know, their already rather punitive brand of secularism. They may start alienating large numbers of French Muslims who certainly don't want the jihadi way, but also don't want to have to pledge allegiance in some compelled fashion. So I worry very much that the National Front approach is going to become the French approach.
George, clearly the Russians and Putin are a major player in this. They want to keep a foothold in the Middle East, and Syria is their only place. And they want to remain or intensify their position as a world player. Where do you think the Russian diplomacy and military action is going to go now that they've seen an airliner blown up over Sinai?
In these talks between Kerry and Lavrov and between Obama and Putin, because they're talking now, how is the U.S. trying to push them away from Assad so that part of this new coalition is based on an understanding that we will pound ISIS and we will begin to create a political transition that has Assad out? Because I don't think the Sunni neighbors or the Sunni Syrians are going to care that we're bombing Raqqa if Assad seems to be gaining the upper hand. In fact, they might be pushed
closer.
And
Assad has gained the upper hand.
Yeah, so that pushes Sunnis closer to the Islamic
State. All I can tell you is what the administration hopes, because I've been doing some reporting in and around State Department, and not that that tells you everything, to say the least. What they hope is that they can put off the personal question of Assad and get the Russians on board toward ceasefire and an agreement on political transformation and keep the name out of it for a little while, but for the understanding to be at a certain point of time, maybe 6 months after, 9 months after, however long it takes to develop a successor figure to Assad, who, by the way, is not going to be a sweetheart. And I've even heard that there are any number of people who would have been putative successors to Assad who have come to bad ends in that extremely dangerous court.
They have a thin bench.
Yeah. It's an increasingly thin bench.
Yeah.
So you're watching a political race take shape now.
Yeah.
And I have to say, so when you watch the Republican debate there, I assume filled with confidence after Ben Carson describes how this will play out.
I just think they're holding their cards back, but they've got a plan and it's a very good one, just as Nixon had a plan for Vietnam.
But is there any politician, Hillary Clinton included, who describes a potential outcome and a potential political process that gives you even a meager sense of confidence?
I don't think they have a clue. What I've been disappointed by is this administration's mistaking its own decision not to get deeply involved in this civil war militarily for involvement of any kind. Diplomatically, we've hardly been a factor until just recently, and it seems all to be driven by Kerry more than by the White House, that this desire.
I think it's driven by what Barack Obama perceives to be his mandate for being elected, and he is stuck by it in a sense that he's been true to what he campaigned on, but he also arguably created a vacuum by leaving too few troops behind in Iraq, which gave a space to the creation of ISIL. This is an argument that's made. And now he's correcting that or trying to in Afghanistan. If you look at our experience in the last X years, not going into Rwanda was a moral and political catastrophe. You know where I'm going. Going into Iraq headlong, moral and political catastrophe. Going in a limited way in Libya, what do we hear in the phrases now? We drop the ball. What a horrible moral thing to hear that we, quote unquote, drop the ball after the intervention in Libya.
But we always, you know, we swing wildly. We're bipolar. We go from we can do anything. It just takes our might and our goodness.
But Obama's under the impression that the right thing to do is, to use the phrase that's vexed him from an article that was published in The New Yorker by Ryan Liz, leading from behind, that somehow a much more subtle American style of participation and coalition building and diplomacy, that somehow that will get us to the gates of heaven.
There was a quote in The New York Times from a former Defense Intelligence Chief, Michael Flynn, who said in 2012 we had an intelligence report that went to the White House saying there's going to be a strong push for a caliphate. It's going to be very powerful. Here's where it's going to happen. And it was completely ignored.
I have to say, either his attention wandered for a certain period of time, or more likely the intelligence on this was terrible. When I interviewed Obama about a year and a half ago in the White House, and I asked him, you know, I said, you say that you've decimated al-Qaeda. And obviously there were other people running around in this nascent group. ISIL was happening. And he said, yeah, you know, some people think if they put on a Lakers jersey, that makes them Kobe Bryant. And it's that clearly signaled, and talk about eyes off the ball, a sense of, if not mission accomplished, then at least a sense of forward progress that we hadn't earned yet.
He wanted to pivot to Asia. You know, as you and I speak right now, he's in Manila, that's an Asia-Pacific economic conference, which is probably what he wanted to be doing with the last 2 years of his presidency. What's he doing? He's answering questions about the Islamic State.
George Packer, thank you.
Thank you, David.
My colleague and friend George Packer. We spoke earlier this week. You can find his article about the suburbs of Paris and some of his coverage of the presidential election at NewYorkerRadio.org. I'm David Remnick.